Today is September 11th, 2026. This is your functional health briefing for provider. In the next 8 to 10 minutes, we'll cover a clinic case series suggesting GLP-1 receptor agonists may lower inflammatory markers before any meaningful weight loss occurs, emerging mitochondrial stress biomarkers like GDF15, and new survey data showing HEDS and HSD diagnostic delay has nearly doubled to 22 years. Let's start with the most clinically provocative finding of the past day. According to McCall McPherson, relayed via Dr. Amy Myers, patients starting GLP-1 or GIP receptor agonists are showing hsCRP reductions within 72 hours to 1 week, well before the 2 to 2.5 month window typically required for meaningful weight loss. In one case, a patient with an 8-year history of treatment refractory elevated CRP saw levels drop from 35 to 11 milligrams per liter over 6 weeks. In 2 additional cases, CRP fell from 11 to 3 and from roughly 6 to under 3 after a single microdose injection with only trivial weight change in all 3 patients. Now, the caveat matters as much as the finding. This is an uncontrolled clinic case series. No randomization, no blinding, no control arm. The clinic tracked hsCRP quarterly in a self-selected cohort, then added ad hoc draws after patients spontaneously reported feeling less inflamed. That's grade D evidence. But biologically, it's plausible. These agents may act on TNF-alpha, IL-1-beta, IL-6, and TGF-beta-1 pathways independent of adiposity loss. Though that specific mechanistic claim still needs independent literature verification before you repeat it to a patient. Here's the evidence-based practice takeaway. If you're already prescribing semaglutide or tirzepatide, consider adding hsCRP to your existing lab panel. Use the standard cardiovascular thresholds. Above 3 mg per liter is elevated risk. Below 1 is optimal. Track it before and shortly after initiation. What you should not do is extrapolate this into a new autoimmune or inflammatory indication for GLP-1 therapy. Frame it to patients as monitoring, not treatment rationale. Moving to mitochondrial biomarkers. Dr. Siobhan Mitchell, MitoQ's chief science officer, speaking on Dr. Kara Fitzgerald's program, laid out 3 markers worth watching: GDF15, mitochondrial DNA copy number, and Dunedin pace. The epigenetic aging clock derived from the Dunedin Multidisciplinary Health and Development Study, a cohort of roughly 1,000 participants now aged 50 to 55. The pattern across this data, mitochondrial dysfunction correlates repeatedly with accelerated Dunedin pace scores, and inflammation trajectories predictive of mortality appear substantially driven by CD4 positive T cell and B cell populations. GDF15 elevation associates with Alzheimer's disease, diabetes, depression, and fatigue severity. But here's the clinical pearl. It also rises acutely with exercise. Mitchell specifically cautions against testing right after high-intensity interval work, because you'll get a false positive. The concerning pattern isn't an acute peak. It's chronic non-resolution. Mitochondrial DNA copy number in peripheral blood, meanwhile, correlates with Alzheimer's, cardiovascular disease, and autoimmune conditions. Neither marker is standard on a functional medicine panel yet, though GDF15 is accessible through metabolomics-type panels if you want to start incorporating it. Mitchell also presented MitoQ's own trial data, and I want to be direct about the conflict of interest here, since she's a company employee. The mechanism is straightforward. MitoQ conjugates a ubiquinone antioxidant to a triphenylphosphonium cation, achieving an estimated 90% mitochondrial delivery, versus about 5% for standard CoQ10. In older adults, 20 mg over 6 weeks was associated with a reported 15% improvement in mitochondrial membrane potential and improved flow-mediated dilation. In postmenopausal women, 40 mg over 4 weeks was associated with vascular function improvements of up to 50% toward premenopausal levels. No sample sizes, confidence intervals, or full citations were given in this interview format. So treat this as hypothesis supporting, not protocol adopting, pending primary source verification. Now to what I'd consider the most actionable material in this briefing, sex-based diagnostic bias, presented by Shilpa Gowalla, APAC at Mayo Clinic Florida, at the Ehlers-Danlos Society's 2026 Female Health Summit. A 2025 global survey of 3,906 patients found the mean diagnostic delay for hypermobile EDS and hypermobility spectrum disorder is now 22.1 years, up from a historical 10 to 12 years. That's not a static problem. It's getting worse. A separate German cohort found a 23-year delay. Patients in these surveys reported an average of 24 comorbid conditions each. Building on that, a multivariate analysis, 89% female, identified diagnostic delay itself as one of three key variables predicting severe pain. 43% of participants reported severe pain. Two-thirds reported significant mobility disability. This connects to a broader pattern Gowalla documented across cardiac and pain care. Females present with chest pain in only 31% of myocardial infarctions, compared to 42% of males, meaning atypical presentation is actually the norm for women having heart attacks. Sex-specific troponin cutoffs have been shown to double acute MI detection rates in females. Separately, a 2022 guideline review found females waited a mean of 16 minutes longer than males for analgesia with equivalent abdominal pain scores, and a 2025 study found females with cardiac chest pain were half as likely as younger males to receive IV morphine. More importantly, here's your evidence-based practice workflow for this. When a female patient presents with joint hypermobility, chronic fatigue, GI dysfunction, or DYS autonomic symptoms, don't wait for a full symptom cluster before naming HEDS or HSD in your differential. Gowalla's data show that roughly 25% of HEDS and HSD patients meet criteria for the full POTS, MCAS, HEDS triad simultaneously. A survey of predominantly female respondents found dysautonomia in 71.4%, POTS in over 50%, and MCAS in 32%. Screen the triad together, rather than sequentially, and practically speaking, proactively naming these conditions in your differential even before formal diagnosis has been shown to reduce perceived dismissal and strengthen therapeutic alliance. That comes from a cross-sectional study of 2,125 U.S. adults with HEDS or HSD, where the single most patient-endorsed request was simply that clinicians demonstrate more disease-specific knowledge. One more data point worth flagging on the research side. Publication volume on connective tissue disorders over the past 5 to 6 years has exceeded the cumulative output of the prior 20 years combined. Despite that surge, the field still hasn't resolved whether HEDS is polygenic or attributable to a single causative mutation, which remains the primary barrier to gene therapy development. A revised EDS diagnostic criteria update is anticipated later this year. A brief note on a contested biomarker claim before we close. Ariana Becker of Mold Co., also via Dr. Amy Myers, proposed tightening the TGF-beta-1 reference range used in SIRS workups, arguing the standard LabCorp cutoff of roughly 22,000 is too permissive, and recommending a threshold closer to 5,000. This comes from a commercially affiliated source selling associated testing with internal unpublished data. Use it, at most, as a research hypothesis. It should not override validated lab reference ranges in your current practice. So where does this leave you for tomorrow's patient visits? If you have patients on GLP-1 or GIP therapy, add hsCRP to their next lab draw and track the trajectory relative to CRP above 3 as elevated risk and below 1 as optimal. Documented as monitoring, not as evidence for a new treatment indication. And for every female patient walking in with unexplained joint pain, fatigue, or autonomic symptoms, actively raise HEDS, HSD, POTS, and MCAS in your differential discussion at that visit, rather than waiting for the full clinical picture to emerge on its own. Given that diagnostic delay itself is now an independent predictor of severe pain and disability, that conversation alone is a clinical intervention. Continue the practice. See you at the next round. That's your core brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.